Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter, Dorothy Gundy, and Brian Lynn. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present America's Presidents. But first, here is Mario Ritter.
Japan's Navy has been taking part in military exercises in the South China Sea over the past 2 months. The exercises are evidence of increased Japanese activity in an area where Japan has long-term interests, including controlling China's influence. In September, a Japanese submarine, helicopter carrier, and two destroyer warships explored parts of the South China Sea. The exercises are part of a two-month program called the Indo-Southeast Asia Deployment 2018. The Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Forces say it is designed to support the interoperability of our partner navies. Last week, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe promised to work with Vietnam on security in the waterway. That statement followed a beach landing exercise involving forces of both Japan and the Philippines. Japan does not claim territory in the South China Sea, as do Vietnam and the Philippines. However, the Japanese do want to keep the sea open to international shipping. China's military buildup in the waterway, then, is a concern. China has been developing man-made islands in the area for its military. Some of these islets now have runways for large military airplanes. Some are defended with missiles. Japan is an ally of the United States. The Japanese also have a territorial dispute with China in the East China Sea. Jeffrey Kingston is a history teacher at Temple University in Japan. He told VOA, "Clearly, Japan wants to send a message to Beijing that China doesn't get to do anything it wants in the South China Sea." Kingston added that Japan is developing relationships with other nations in East Asia, and the exercises are likely to continue. These exercises are going to become the new norm, he said. Japan started intensifying ties with Southeast Asia about 20 years ago, when China began expanding its own economic relations in the area. Since 1999, Japan has cut back on its development aid to China. In March, Japan announced plans to lend money to the Philippines for Manila's first subway system. Japan also has helped rebuild Marawi, a Philippine city partly destroyed by civil war in 2017. Last year, Japan also promised to work closely with Australia, India, and the United States to keep the South China Sea open to shipping. Stephen Nagy is an associate professor in politics and international studies at the International Christian University in Tokyo. He said Japan wants other countries to agree on international maritime norms. Brunei, Malaysia, Taiwan, Vietnam, and the Philippines all claim parts of the South China Sea. In June, Japan offered a $23 million grant to Indonesia for building ports that face the sea. 2 years ago, Japan offered loans and grants to the Philippines for naval patrol ships. And last month, a Japanese submarine visited Vietnam. Nagy said Southeast Asia looks to Japan as a counterbalance to China. He said Japan and its allies are trying to develop an agreement on how international law should be obeyed by countries within the region. China has protested Japan's recent submarine activity, saying it took place in Chinese waters. The state-operated website ChinaDaily.com said the activity was testing one of China's red lines, meaning one of its sensitive areas. I'm Mario Ritter.
Cuba does not have public opinion studies, campaigns, or large independent media groups, but meetings about reforming the country's constitution have launched an unusual public debate. Cuba's government has organized the meetings. They are part of a nearly two-month period during which Cubans are invited to discuss a draft of the country's new constitution. Cuba's National Assembly and ruling Communist Party have already approved the draft. Government officials are expected to review the public's comments and add the ideas into a final constitution. The public will then have a chance to approve it next February. But it is unknown how many and which ideas will be included. Cuba's single-party government does not have a history of showing the people how it works or giving them a strong voice. However, as a result of the meetings, everyday people are formally talking to each other about Cuba's political system and values. Some are calling for a direct election of the president and other officials. We don't need multi-party democracy, but we should have direct elections, Ronaldo Gonzalez said during a meeting in Havana. Currently, members of the National Assembly choose the president of Cuba, and government-controlled groups choose the members of the National Assembly. Many Cubans are objecting to a constitutional amendment that would permit same-sex marriage. Hilario Brock, who calls himself a loyal revolutionary, said, "Nature says marriage should be between a man and a woman." However, the daughter of Raul Castro, the country's Communist Party leader, strongly supports the amendment. Mariela Castro leads the country's Institute of Sexual Health and Education. She has pushed for increased rights for homosexuals. But most of the proposed changes are not major reforms. For example, the draft identifies roles for foreign investment and private property. These reforms have already been part of a slow move over the last 10 years toward a more market economy. Other changes deal with the country's large government structure. They suggest creating the positions of a prime minister and area governor. Reporters from the Associated Press have been attending some of the meetings. They say many Cubans believe the new constitution aims to make the current situation in the country official. They note that many people in the government were revolutionary fighters with Fidel Castro. Those officials may want to make sure things stay the same before they retire or pass away. The meetings have shown that Cubans are informed, interested, and excited to talk about their country. Citizens meet in public areas and parks across the country. Many carry cards with the 224 articles of the proposed constitution. They stand for the national song. Then they share their opinions while someone takes notes. The comments are later sent to the Constitutional Reform Commission, which is led by Raul Castro. Arturo Lopez Levy was born and educated in Cuba and is now an international relations professor in the United States. He said the debates have demonstrated that people in other countries underestimate the extent of debate and popular feedback in the Cuban system. Constitutional lawyer Julio Fernandez Estrada noted that the meetings have been extremely good and useful. However, he is worried about how much of the public's opinions might actually be included in the final draft of the Constitution. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
A United States federal court in Boston, Massachusetts, is hearing a discrimination case against the oldest university in the country. The nonprofit organization Students for Fair Admissions first took legal action against Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in 2014. It says the school discriminates against Asian Americans seeking admission. The legal action accuses Harvard of holding Asian American students to higher requirements than students of other races. It says the university uses racial balancing policies that unlawfully limit how many Asian American students it accepts. The organization argues that race should not be considered when deciding which students to accept. the use of racial classifications and preferences is unfair, unnecessary, and unconstitutional, the group says on its website. It accuses the school of discriminating against Asian Americans seeking admission by giving them a personal rating. Lawyers for Students for Fair Admissions said these ratings seek to measure personal qualities such as courage and likability. Such qualities are measured subjectively, leaving the process open to discrimination, the lawyers argued. The group says it has more than 20,000 members, including students, parents, and others. Harvard denies using discriminatory practices in its admissions process. The Ivy League school says it uses race as one of many things it considers in admissions decisions. It believes considering race can help create a mixed community where students from all walks of life can learn with and from each other. Education and employment policies that consider race are known as affirmative action. Supporters say these policies can help make up for historic, widespread racial discrimination of minority groups. Critics have long argued that affirmative action is unfair to white people and Asian Americans who outperform other groups on academic measures. The U.S. Supreme Court has heard several cases about affirmative action in recent years. The Supreme Court's most recent decision on the subject approved limited use of race in the admission process. That 2016 decision came from a lawsuit against the University of Texas that accused the school of discriminating against white students. Harvard leaders have said the school only considers race in the way earlier Supreme Court cases have ruled is permitted. The university has also noted that its share of Asian Americans has grown in recent years, reaching 23%. Of the latest first-year class. Harvard reports that 15.2% of its most recent first-year class is African American. Hispanic or Latino students make up 12.3%, while 1.9% are Native American. That leaves a remaining group of mainly white students at under 50%. President Donald Trump's administration supports the argument against Harvard. In July, the Trump administration announced it was withdrawing government guidelines meant to increase student diversity at U.S. schools. The guidelines were developed during the presidency of Barack Obama. The guidance stated that schools could consider race in admissions decisions as long as the policies did not violate Supreme Court decisions. The U.S. Justice Department said it was withdrawing the guidelines because it considered them unnecessary or outdated. Civil rights groups criticized the move, and some university officials said they would continue their efforts toward mixed student populations as before. I'm Brian Lynn.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents.
Today we are talking about Chester A. Arthur. The letter A is for Allen, his middle name. Arthur took office because of an unexpected event. He was sworn in as vice president in March 1881 under James Garfield. But only 100 days into Garfield's term, the president was shot. He suffered for months. Arthur was not close to Garfield. The two men belonged to the same party, but they had different ideas on the issues of the day. They publicly disagreed on a number of subjects. If Garfield lived, Arthur would probably not have much power in his administration. But Garfield eventually died. By this time, it was well established that if the President of the United States dies in office, the Vice President becomes the President. So, in September 1881, Arthur became the country's chief executive. He served the remaining 3.5 years of Garfield's term. Historians say that, for the most part, Arthur performed ably and well. Chester Arthur was raised in the northeastern states of Vermont and New York. He was one of 8 children in his family. Their father was a religious leader and anti-slavery activist. Arthur attended college in New York, then taught school and studied law. But he never wanted to stay in a small town and live modestly. He wanted to live in New York City, work as a lawyer and public official, become wealthy, and enjoy the lifestyle of a gentleman. And that is what he did. Arthur advanced from an entry-level job in a law office to a leadership position in the military during the Civil War. After the fighting stopped, he worked in a good-paying job as a lawyer, and then accepted a top position in the government. For 7 years, Arthur served as the collector of the Port of New York. His job involved supervising 1,300 people. They collected large amounts of money that came from taxes on imported goods. The job had a political element, too. It was under the control of a U.S. senator from New York, Roscoe Conkling. Conkling was known as a Republican Party chief who traded political support for financial and other benefits. Arthur was never found guilty of accepting money or gifts in exchange for the help of his office, but he was closely linked to Conkling's political machine. When Rutherford B. Hayes became president in 1878, he tried to fight corruption in government jobs. He targeted Conkling and Arthur. Arthur's position as the collector of the Port of New York was one of the issues in the election of 1880. President Hayes had suspended Arthur from the job. To get it back, Arthur and Conkling supported an effort to re-elect former president Ulysses S. Grant. But another candidate won the Republican Party's presidential nomination, James Garfield. Garfield and Arthur were not natural allies. Although they were both Republicans, they represented different points of view. Political leaders hoped to unite the party. So when Garfield was chosen as the presidential candidate, they added Arthur as the vice presidential nominee. The effort to unite the party worked well enough to win the election, but relations between the two men were uneasy. One of Garfield's first acts was to appoint someone for Arthur's old job in New York. The new president wanted someone who was not loyal to Conkling, so he gave the position to one of his supporters instead. In protest, Conkling resigned from the Senate. But then events took an unexpected turn. Garfield was shot by a mentally unbalanced man who believed the president owed him a government job. And Chester A. Arthur became president. When Arthur took office, he had the public image of being an experienced political operator. Most people believed he cared only about supporting the aims of a small part of the Republican Party. Instead, President Arthur took an independent position on several issues. In opposition to most of his party, Arthur supported legislation to reform the country's civil service. It aimed to clean up corruption in government and took away some of the ability of politicians to give government jobs to their supporters. To be fair, in the short term, the act helped Arthur's party. Arthur also broke with the Republican Party leadership to support a reduction in tariffs, and he strongly argued to limit spending federal money on projects that helped only a few areas or businesses. Instead, he wanted to cut taxes so more people would profit from the government's surplus. Finally, Arthur vetoed an anti-immigration act from Congress. The measure proposed banning Chinese immigrants for 20 years. Arthur argued that the Chinese had improved the American economy by helping build a railroad across the country. He also did not want to hurt potential trade with China. However, when Congress offered to ban Chinese immigrants for only 10 years, Arthur agreed. In addition, his administration banned immigrants who were considered poor, criminal, or mentally insane. Perhaps Arthur's most memorable act as president, however, was to redecorate the White House. He did not like its appearance inside, so he asked one of New York's top designers, Louis Tiffany, to make the home brighter and more stylish. In the newly remodeled rooms, Arthur held parties with fine food and drink for elite guests. He was known as the gentleman boss. Observers then and now say that Arthur served well as president. He was a solid leader after the difficult years of the Civil War and Reconstruction. But Arthur did not live much beyond his presidency. Shortly into his term, he learned he had a serious kidney disease that would likely kill him. As a result, he did not try hard to get reelected. Instead, after finishing his term, he returned to his home in New York. Arthur tried to work as a lawyer, but he soon became too sick. His wife had died of malaria before he became president, and he liked to spend his free time fishing or with friends instead of with his children. But in his last months, he could not enjoy those activities either. He died at home at the age of 57.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.